We are now in a process which is typified by the act of the president or the chief of the Bank of England, Eddie George, in looting his own bank of up to $1 billion and probably more, in concert with an international syndicate which includes the backers of Vice President and fading presidential candidate Al Gore. This act of the Bank of England stealing from itself for the benefit of a group of cronies, of the director of the Bank of England and of the Queen of England, is typical of these times. It must be said that what happened to Russia during the past 6 years was found so good by the Western banking system that they have imported the Russian model of stealing from your own country and its assets into the West. Well, for example, there's nothing remarkable or unique in what Eddie George is doing. In every part of the world, we have a form of criminality called privatization. Privatization is a multi-syllable word for stealing. For example, in Germany, the Stadtwerke, the municipal utilities, are the present object of stealing under the label of privatization, something that every Russian can understand. When you're going to privatize a firm, you're going to steal from it. That's what privatization means. It used to be called in the 18th century and the 17th century privateering. That's where people would get a legal license to go out and loot. Sometimes they were called pirates, and if they had a piece of paper from a government, they were called privateers. So you don't call the Russian liberals pirates, you call them privateers, because they've been given a special license to steal from their own countries, their own country, their own banks, and everything else in sight. The privateers even steal from each other. And when times get tough, the frequency and intensity of stealing from one another increases. It can be said, with probably a rare exception, that at this point, every leading bank and every leading other financial house in the world is engaged primarily in stealing from its own assets. Now, in the case of Eddie George's stealing of gold, what happens is that the gold is stolen by selling it below its value to a private syndicate of cronies. A small group of people are allowed to buy this gold below price. They are going to hoard that gold until after the great financial crash wipes out all financial institutions around the world. And that's in process now. When the crash is over, they intend to come back with their gold. In the meantime, they're driving down the price of gold in order to bankrupt the gold mines in South Africa, Russia, and so forth. So they will buy up the gold mines, which have gone bankrupt, and they will control the world's gold and gold production after the crash is over, not far into the future. Every bank is doing the same thing, or virtually every bank. Maybe there's an exception here and there, but I've checked with some bankers, and they don't know of any exceptions. Every bank and financial house is stealing from itself. That is, the relevant directors are stealing assets, and by various kinds of loan mechanisms and others, with which I'm familiar from the old days and investigating frauds and bankruptcies and so forth and probate proceedings in the United States and Canada. What they do is they move the money through a lending procedure or a trade procedure at reduced prices to a second party who passes it on to a third party who passes it on to a fourth party. And the fourth party is the collaborator of the person in the bank who is doing the stealing. When the crash comes, each of the intervening parties, including the bank itself, will go bankrupt. And the bank official hopes to retire on the basis of what has been stolen by the fourth party. It's the old method of stealing. It was practiced in the 1950s, the 1960s, in the United States and Canada. I investigated many such cases. What is being done now is no different, except that it's done on a grand global scale. Whenever you hear the word privatization, you scream, thief. Catch thief. Stop thief. Every time you hear a privatization of a Stadtwerke in Germany, you say, stop thief. When you hear somebody proposing it, stop you, accomplice of a thief. That politicians who are owned by financial interests are bought and they put through the laws of privatization which enable people to steal. There is the greatest amount of theft in history now going on around the world. Government politicians, governments as such, are stealing. They are stealing for the people who pay them, who support the political parties, who have bought and paid for the politicians, who are now stealing for pay under the guise of being elected and other officials. Why is this going on? Why doesn't somebody stop it? Well, this thing can go on only under one condition, that stealing at such levels, on such a scale, with such profundity, it only happens when the system is about to go under. When every one of the people behind authorizing and covering up and steering the stealing operation knows that the entire world financial system is about to blow. Those who tell you that the system will not crash because they have it under crisis management are lying. They are lying why? To buy a few more weeks and months at most in order to complete the process of stealing. In order to steal, they have to keep you quiet, confused, and believing that the system will not crash. That's how they steal. So when a banker says the system will not crash, he is lying. Every leading banker in the world knows the system is crashing because they're stealing. And they wouldn't dare steal the way they were stealing if they didn't know the system were about to crash. And if they didn't know that virtually every other banking and related financial institution in the world is doing exactly the same thing, so they don't blow the whistle on each other. That's what's happening. In the end, they will rob every savings account. They will loot everything and leave the poor public, especially those who are foolish enough to invest in mutual funds, absolutely destitute. That's the situation we're now in. For example, the system began to disintegrate in the spring and summer of 1998. We had entered the phase for this during the summer into October of 1997. The process leading into this had been established in 1994, 1995 with the Mexico crisis and the mishandling of the Mexico crisis by the United States in the so-called bailout. So these are the steps. So we've entered step by step, going back all the way to the middle of the 1960s, in fact. But in terms of financial systems, 1971, and then the Carter administration in the United States. The famous names who were responsible politically for setting this into motion include the first and second Harold Wilson government in Britain. And you see the result of the Harold Wilson government in a television report yesterday on the British Sky TV News of the Great Western Railway System, which is a privatized section of the former British rail system, a victim of Thatcher. This privatized rail system had a crash. And a crash occurred because of privatization. People were killed because of privatization. Because the only way to make profit out of the bankrupt system is to gut it. So the safety signals, which should have been operating, about six of them, according to the British report, didn't function. So the train crashed and people were killed. This is typical of the effects of privatization. You saw the same thing with a crash in Hanover of the ICE, where a cheaper rail, a cheaper wheel was used. Safety precautions were not done. The same thing was done in the German rail system that was done at Mercedes-Benz with the A-Klasse, of scrapping the engineering departments, which are necessary to develop and prove workable systems, and letting a computer idiot, a nerd, a mere nerd, not a human being, but a nerd, on a computer, decide how the thing shall be designed. A nerd who understands nothing about the principles of physical science, but thinks that if you know how to operate a computer and a little mathematics, you can solve all problems. This is a form of psychosis. This is not anything else. So you see, all over the world, the private and public systems are being looted consciously, willfully, with willful criminal negligence. They call it negligence, but it was willful. What do you call that? It's called an intentional crime. If you strip away safety systems, for example, you might say, by U.S. standards, that the great Western victims of the Great Western Railway crash this week were the victims of HMO-style management. HMO-style management, that is the privatized takeover of medical insurance programs, the cutting of medical care, as Andrea Fischer pushes that here in Germany, is calculated mass murder. If you adjust the conditions of life such as to wittingly increase the death rate and suffering rate, you are a mass murderer. If you do this for financial reasons, then it's a crime whose motivation is murder, is stealing. But this is typical what is happening with the HMO or the medical system inside the United States. What is typical of congressmen of the United States who are bought and paid for by Wall Street, who put through the bills which do not allow the victim of an HMO murder to sue for the damages in case of injury or loss of life, for criminal negligence. This is a characteristic of the present world system. Now, what about crisis? When people hear about crisis, they think about the 1929 crash, or perhaps the 1923 blowout of the Reichsmark and the great hyperinflation. Well, you want to know about Germany, Weimar, Reichsmark blowout in 1923? It's happening right here in the United States, on a world scale, in Germany, everywhere. The same thing is happening. What has happened is, and that's what the present phase of the situation is. This is why all bankers generally are stealing, why privateers are stealing, why bought and paid for government officials are voting for stealing, which is called liberalization. Don't make crime a crime anymore, liberalize it. You don't call people immoral, you call them liberal. You don't call them murderers, you call them liberal. In the old days, they would have called a Nazi death camp manager a liberal, because he was liberally handling the problem. This is the way the world we're in. What's happening? During this entire period, you had a series of steps. First of all, you had the shift to a post-industrial utopia, which started in institutions around the world, which were influenced by the famous Frankfurt School here in Germany. There was the center of it. The new post-industrial culture, the so-called baby boomer culture, or the 1968 culture, which you saw in universities and other institutions, but especially university populations in the United States and Europe in 1964 to 1968 and beyond. So that from that point on, there was an attempt to reverse progress, to reverse scientific and technological progress, and to say we must stop progress and go on to a different kind of society. Some people said plainly what they meant. They referred to Nietzsche's program of the dawning of the age of Aquarius. This was called the New Age. It was called various other things. I called it a few things myself. But I didn't call it New Age. All right, this was done. So a generation of students at universities were brainwashed. And those that were not brainwashed generally did not get such good careers. Those who became totally idiots, immoral, were advanced when they got out of their universities to higher and higher positions. And most of them are running the top positions in government and in finance and so forth in the United States and Europe today. That's how it happened. Then the Vietnam War was a great impetus, and the Vietnam War opposition was largely based in the United States on pure cowardice. The people in universities were opposed to the war because they didn't want to go to Vietnam and get killed. Therefore, they discovered a conscience. The conscience says, I'm not going. We used to call it draft dodging. It was actually that. It was that simple, plain cowardice. I was there. I saw it. I met these people. Don't tell me it was something else. It was plain cowardice. There were a few of us who thought the whole thing was a horror show and not to be stopped. But we didn't go that way. We went a different way to try to get the policy changed, to get the problem. So these cowards with no morality and a baby boomer style of indifference to reality, flying into my personal feelings, not into their responsibilities for the future. Completely selfish and concerned about their personal feelings about things and negotiating their personal feelings with everybody, including feeling everybody up, so to speak. This became a cultural change. The cultural change was symptomized by the introduction in the U.S. State Department in 1966-67 of a policy that the United States State Department thereafter would, in its dealings with other countries, would shape its policies with a regard to the need to reduce population growth in overpopulated countries, which usually turned out at the time to be so-called third world countries. We must reduce the population of the third world countries. And therefore, the economic and other foreign policies of the United States must be shaped to foster the cessation of population growth in developing countries, even reduce the population in developing countries. And this process had started in 1961 with a meeting between a former member of the Nazi SS, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, and the Duke of Windsor, Prince Philip of England. They founded the World Wildlife Fund, and they were the kind of world wildlife, I suppose, that you would they were working for. They also founded the 1001 Club, which is a group of influential financial circles to fund the operations of the World Wildlife Fund, and this was the birth of this time of the so-called organized environmentalist movement. Then in 1972, under British control, but in a meeting in Stockholm, the international environmentalist movement, or the Green Movement, was officially launched. It had been organized beforehand with a founding by British intelligence, Dr. Alexander King, Lord Solly Zuckerman, and so forth, of the Club of Rome, which is a continuation of the 1001 Club operations and the World Wildlife Fund. It was followed, since the Soviet Union would not join the Club of Rome directly for various reasons, so their efforts were made to do so. They founded in Luxembourg, Austria, they founded the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, which was a subsidiary of Cambridge University, England, a subsidiary of the so-called Systems Analysis Group under the leadership of Lord Cawdor at Cambridge University in Britain. So in 1972, these various currents of people haters had a conference in Sweden which launched the International Green Movement, which prepared to destroy science, technology, and its applications, and to do everything possible to increase the death rates and the abortion rates among populations, especially in third world countries and also in Germany. In all this, there's a common thread. The British hate the Germans. They say they love them, but they love, what they love is to see them die. As Thatcher expressed this view in 1989 and 1990. Keep the Germans down, don't let them prosper. Germany is a great danger, it must be kept down. And Thatcher and Mitterrand, supported by George Bush, agreed. That's why Germany has problems today, for that reason. But these were the policies. Then in 1971, to further this same Age of Aquarius policy, poor dumb Nixon, and if you read the this week's edition of the New U.S. News and World Report, you note that American politicians cannot be elected president unless they're stupid. This has been my great difficulty. Actually, Clinton is not stupid, but he's a baby boomer, and sometimes it works to the same effect. A certain cowardice and vacillation and so forth, even though he's under tremendous pressure and death threats and so forth. So a stupid Nixon, who was actually rather stupid. Some people have said the contrary, but everything I've seen, including private discussions and what statements he made over the years, the man was not intelligent. He was sly. But a snake can be sly. Even the dumbest krait snake, this little brown worm-like snake whose bite will kill a man in about 60 seconds, he can be sly. And he's about the dumbest snake there is in all creation. So some of our politicians, like Jimmy Carter, for example, are like that. So this dumb president, Richard Nixon, made a decision under pressure on August 16th, 17th, 15th, 16th, 17th of 1971, which crashed the post-war international financial system and created what was called a floating exchange rate system. The entire reconstruction of the world economy following World War II had been based on a system of fixed exchange rates, not adjustable but not floating parities, on a U.S.-centered, gold reserve-based system with extreme protectionist measures of the forms of capital controls exerted internationally, exchange controls enforced internationally, and by sovereign governments, and by financial controls applied internally. Without these measures, an interest rate in the 1-2% globally, you could never have had the recovery from in Europe and other countries from World War II. Could not have happened. Now, people who are small-minded, foolish, Don't pay attention to reality. Say, if it isn't going to happen next week, I'm not concerned about it. People with slightly larger minds will say, well, if it's not going to happen next year, I'm not concerned about it. Politicians generally say, well, if it's not going to happen until after the next election, I'm not concerned about it. This is the kind of world we live in, with a lot of very stupid people. Not stupid because they were born stupid, but stupid because they are part of cultures which stupefy them. To be a human being in European civilization, you have to go back to ancient Greece. You have to relive ancient Greece. You have to, in a sense, start by reference to the epics of Homer, whether you read them in the original Greek or not. You must start with the epics of Homer. Because in the epics of Homer, you have a picture of the mind of the Greek of the period to which these epics refer. As a very poor fellow who did not believe he could think. The function of education is to make the most important of these ideas, ideas of physical principle, ideas of classical art, to make these the personal property of a developing young mind. So that the young mind coming out of an educational process and out of the life experience of growing up becomes an adult person who in that degree and sense embodies all of history before them. For generations and generations and generations. And by direct knowledge, that is by replication of discoveries, they know much about history. They know the names of discoverers. The inner mind of Plato is more familiar to them than the bum who's walking across the street. They know him better. They have a closer relationship to Plato than that poor bum, that poor penner. That is history. It's to see yourself, to see the past, to see the future as this kind of continuing process. People who don't know history are called slaves. They're slaves in literal sense, or they are kept like animals, not knowing where they came from, and not knowing where their children are going. They have no control over their own lives, control over their own nation. They are meaningless, existentialist wanderers in a post-industrial nightmare, a post-modernist nightmare. And that's what's been destroyed. The character, the essential moral character of populations has been systematically destroyed by what came out of the Frankfurt School and what the Frankfurt School came out of, by the baby boomer culture of the 1960s, and what has followed, especially is typified by the destruction of science, by the destruction of technological progress, and by the destruction, above all, of education and morality. The greatest progress which mankind has made in establishing the principle of equality of human beings was made through the creation of the institution of the sovereign nation state, which actually began in the middle of the 15th century in Europe. The nation state means essentially that for the first time, after a long period of the Babylonian, Roman, Byzantine, and other empires, and feudalism, for the first time it was defined that the function of the state is a principle called, in the U.S. Constitution, the general welfare. That the state is responsible, accountable not to the opinions of the people, because the opinions of the people are diverse. How can you say we represent public opinion? There is no such thing as public opinion. Opinion in any society is highly diversified. There is no uniform public opinion, except among lynch mobs, deranged mobs. What there is a sense of accountability of the state to care for all the people, to provide justice for all the people. As the character Socrates in Plato's Republic defined justice as a principle of natural law. So the state is now bound to be the servant of history, the servant of the history of all of the people, the welfare, promotion, well-being of all of the people, justice for all of the people, progress for all of the people. And the state must be an instrument for all of the people in that way, not for their public opinion, but for all of the people. Somebody is suffering, they're one of all of the people. What do we do about it? Injustice, what do we do about it? The state is responsible. It has the final responsibility, and its character is this caring for all of the people, including the legacy of past generations and the welfare of future generations. That is what was destroyed by the process which I've described, especially that of the 1960s as consolidated in 1971-72. So in 1971-72, the world was sliding down the road to hell. But because most people are very small-minded and think only about their pensions or think about their neighborhood or think about the next election or foolish things like that, they said, well, if it's far away, it really isn't important, is it? Now, let's take the case of a planet. Now, the solar system is rather old. It had a beginning when there were no planets. The sun, which was then spinning rapidly, dizzy because there was nothing to look at, just the sun. Looking around, looking for planets, no planets to see. So the sun was spinning. Now, what the sun was doing, this spinning was a headache. So, just like a man sweating takes off clothing, the sun began to shed some of its rotation. And it created a corona, which probably would have looked something like the corona of Saturn, the rings of Saturn, around itself as it spun this material off. Now, because of the nature of rotation, this particular material became polarized. And subject to radiation from the sun, this material went through a process of thermonuclear fusion, producing not just from helium and hydrogen and so forth, began to produce higher orders of elements of the periodic table. And it spun these off in a great centrifuging kind of operation, and the heavier material concentrated on what became known as the inner planets, and the lighter material was concentrated in the outer planets. And all of these things were displayed according to a lawful principle. And from that time on, and when these planets appeared, formed in this way, in their pre-assigned orbits, the orbital system has more or less stayed there for billions of years. Now, how did this happen? Well, it happened because of the orbit is not a result of a Newtonian relationship among planets and the sun. The orbits are a result of a trajectory, an orbit itself. So the orbit determines the position of the planet, not Newtonian forces or Galileo forces. These forces, as Jonathan and Bruce have documented in a recent issue for Daleo, how Gauss confirmed that the accuracy of Kepler's calculations for the orbit of a missing but formerly necessary planet, which had exploded because of its orbit, confirms it, shows that the way in which this orbit is determined is not explained by Newtonian or similar kinds of things, but by things which are very small, almost infinitesimal differences. but which are regular, which are persistent. They're not constant, but they're consistent and regular. And thus the orbit of a planet has been determined over billions of years again and again and again. Even more. The orbit undergoes changes, but these changes are built into the system. And that's gone on for billions and billions of years. Now, a scientist who wants to think about astronomy must think in those terms. Now, what about society? In society, if you choose an axiom, an assumption, a policy, and society begins to behave according to the influence of that axiom, that assumption, then society will take a trajectory of development, like a planetary orbit, which will carry it with great regularity toward a predefined destination. In some cases, if that's a bad orbit, society is doomed. And society can escape from this doom only by changing its orbital characteristics. The changes which I referred to, which occurred in the 1960s and early 1970s, were a decision to change the parameters, the orbital characteristics of European civilization. What we have seen is the lawful unfolding, the unfolding of the seasons and the Earth's orbit. This has undergone lawfully a succession of transformations, which has brought us now to the doom of the system. Just the way an orbital trajectory will determine the doom of a comet which over millions of years has been following a track which destines it to die in the sun. Therefore, people who are stupid say, well, I didn't know from my experience in the past week, I don't think that works at all. From my experience of observing the sun in the past month, I wouldn't say that winter's ever coming. That is the problem we have, that people are so small-minded and so concerned with false values that they blind themselves with illusion to the reality of what is happening. So what we've described, and what I've described actually, over more than 35 years, in point of fact, when I was in 1963 horrified, but what I recognized was about to happen, and said this civilization that continues in this direction is doomed. This is the greatest danger civilization has had in all modern times. I was right. The problem was I was faced with a lot of dumb people who said, no, that couldn't happen. My experience says that could never happen. Well, often things happen that have never happened before. I take, for example, go back to the situation now, again. People are saying, where's the crash? Today, where's the crash? You talk about crash. Where's the crash? Well, the problem is, buddy, there's so many crashes occurring every month, you don't even notice them anymore. For example, on June 10th, 11th of 1999, there was a bigger crash than the crash of last October. Bigger. That is, the crash that occurred on June 10th, 11th, worldwide, this year, was bigger than the crash that occurred last October. The whole system went into a phase shift where crash, which occurred in February, centered around the Brazil crisis. The Brazil crisis, which is addressed by George Soros, collaborates with George Soros to flood the thing with money, was not an end to the crash. The crash occurred. What crashed was a phase shift in the system, which has defined the present terminal stage of the system today. What do they do? By flooding the system with money in February of 1999, following the flooding with money on a lesser scale in October of 1988, what did they do? They did something which was only parallel on a limited scale is what was done in Weimar, Germany in 1923. In order to deal with the debt crisis associated with the French occupation of the Rhineland and the threat of France to reoccupy and loot all of Germany if the debts weren't paid on time, the Versailles debts, the German government went into the printing press mode to pay these debts to France, especially, and to blackmail of French bayonets. That resulted in a phase change in all German politics, which produced the rise of Hitler, which was done by these guys. Now, what they did in printing money, if you look at the record of the early part of the year, as Bill Engdahl has done a report on some of this, you see that the rate of inflation, the manifest rate of inflation inside Germany during the early periods of this great money printing operation, the effects were rather moderate as inflation goes. Then suddenly, it reached a point in late spring, early summer of 1923, at which everyone in the banking system, then as now, recognized the Reichsmark was doomed. And they did then as they're doing now, as Eddie George illustrates the case. They began stealing left and right to squirrel assets away, or the nuts were storing squirrels, I guess, in this point, right? To put assets away for the post-crash effects. They knew the system was going to blow out, the Reichsmark was doomed. So they got their money out of the system, and they either bought foreign cash at fire sale prices, whatever, they would sacrifice anything to get some money parked someplace where they thought it would be safe. Or they would buy hard commodity assets, which they thought they would be able to control and use after the crash of the Reichsmark had occurred. The entire population of Germany, which depended upon financial savings, was bankrupted by the resulting effect. Just as the mutual funds holders in the United States, which consists of about 40 million families, will be wiped out by what's about to happen. So as these guys began dumping assets in order to park some part of those assets out of the system at a safe place, either as hard commodity forms or as foreign currency, what the effect of this was to drive up prices inside the German economy. The result was a rapid devaluation of the mark, to which the Reichsbank responded by increasing the rate of printing of Reichsmarks. So that over the process of the summer into fall of 1923, the whole system went into a hyperbolic, hyperinflationary, zooming of both depreciation of Reichsmarks and prices, commodity prices. What happened during this spring, as manifest at the beginning of June of this year, was a phase shift in the hyperinflationary process, which was set into motion by the events, first of 1997, October 1997, and then by the ensuing developments of the spring into October of 1998. The Brazil crisis, in the attempt to wall this thing over with money, with a collaboration with Soros, accelerated this process. In the process, the swindlers, in trying to maneuver money and assets around, relied upon an agreement which Larry Summers, the current dumber version of a U.S. Treasury Secretary, negotiated with Japan. Whereas Reuben had said in 1997, not a nickel to save the banks, Larry Summers and his Japanese government went for the opposite policy of save the banks and sacrifice Japan to save the banks, to bail the banks. This resulted in Japan was printing money through its central banking function by dropping the interest rate to what became as low as 0.25% or lower. What then happened was that these guys who were trying to get out of the European, the US, Brazil, other crises, What they did was they began to borrow yen overnight at 0.25% on short term. They would then take the borrowed yen to buy dollars, Deutschmarks, and so forth, and euros. Okay? Now, the danger was that if the collapse of the dollar, euro, and so forth proceeded, then the value of the yen would go up. If the value of the yen went up, then the people who had borrowed yen at 0.25% would have to pay the difference between the old price of the yen and the new price as payment, as the equivalent of interest payment, as back payment. They would then all go bankrupt. And since most of this is called the yen carry trade, since most of the world was up to its ears in a vast flood of yen generated by the yen carry trade at 0.25% from the yen central banking system, Japanese, that the whole system was ready to go entirely. So now what you have, this is called crisis management. We will crisis management manage our way through the system so no crisis will occur. What they said is what someone from various banks said here. No, you're wrong. The system will never crash. We will manage it. Yes, there are problems, but we'll manage it. There was a meltdown before, but there won't be a meltdown now. It won't happen. Why wasn't it going to happen? Because they were going to get through it with crisis management. The key instrument of crisis management had become the international yen carry trade. Now the yen carry trade threatened to blow out the entire system. And therefore, they began pouring from the euro, from the United States and so forth, pouring everything they could get into trying to push down the price of the yen or keep the price down. While in Japan itself, they were trying to keep the yen down, but they were also trying to keep the borrowing costs on the yen below 0.25%, as was said by Japanese officials, down to virtually zero. So you had the yen carry trade, which involved the most hyperinflationary operation, just as hyperinflationary as in the worst period of the Weimar hyperinflation of the 1923, run through the yen carry trade on a world scale. The whole system now hanged on crisis management, and the crisis management was held on the keystone of the yen carry trade. The yen carry trade now threatened to blow up the system. Thus, the crisis management became the disease. This is the terminal stage of cancer in a financial system. This is where we presently are. We are now in a system where the more they try to keep the system alive, the bigger and quicker it falls. It's over. The party is over. The comet is about to enter the sun. The travel along the long trajectory is now about to be completed with a certain finality. So the question is, so the system is finished, the banks will be gone, the world will be bankrupt, no hope of recovery, what do we do? Well, John Kenneth Galbraith, and years ago, he's still alive, by the way, and probably smarter than any banker in Germany, said of the 1929 crash, what was falling was just paper. What is collapsing in Russia and other places today is only paper. The only reason we're suffering is we're paying too much attention to that paper. Why don't we burn the paper? Well, just to indicate, I've written a piece which reports on some aspects of this, which will be published in the July 30th edition of EIR. But just to indicate what the perspective is. What do we have to do? Well, you have to have means present. Otherwise, it's going to be tough to make it. May not make it. Yeah? Or the idea that I'm going to become president. That'll do the same thing. First of all, a group of governments, and I have chosen the United States, joined by cowardly Germany, with Russia, China, India, and a few other countries, simply decides as an executive decision the following. The world financial situation is hopeless, a hopeless catastrophe. Nothing can save the world financial system in its present form. Therefore, let's stop trying to save the world financial system, all monetary system, in their present form. What do we do? Number one, we declare and avow that we are each perfectly sovereign nation states and have the absolute power embodied in us by virtue of being perfectly sovereign nation states. Globalization just died. We killed it. All right, so first thing we do with sovereign nations, we declare that all gambling debts, including derivatives and junk bonds, are now retroactively declared to be null and void. No one among us will ever honor again any gambling debts such as financial derivatives and junk bonds. Now, that does the positive thing of taking at least $300 trillion of current financial debt out of the world system. If you don't do that, there is no possibility of reorganizing society and saving civilization. That's the price. Either you cancel $300 trillion approximately of gambling debts, such as financial derivatives, and say they are null and void as if they had never existed, which sovereign governments can do. If they're perfectly sovereign, and if they represent nations which represent the majority of the human race, that's a pretty good decision. About as good as you can get on this planet. That's the beginning. What about the rest of the junk? Put it into bankruptcy reorganization. Freeze it. Freeze the accounts. Terminate interest payments on these accounts. End it. Right? Government takes over. The government puts each part of its society into generalized bankruptcy reorganization under state supervision. You want to survive? You're going to do that. If you don't do it, you're not going to survive. As you have no choice. The comet has reached the sun. You have no choice. Well, what do you do then? Well, you then say, we're going to do a number of things. First of all, we're going to use, as the legal principle here, the General Welfare Clause of the preamble of the U.S. Constitution, which is the only constitution which has the provision of Socratic or Platonic natural law in it, the General Welfare Clause. This is the principle on which all European civilization, modern civilization, was based, beginning from the time of the France under Louis XI. That's the great revolution, the establishment of the sovereign nation state. The power of the sovereign nation state and its obligation to enforce the principle of the general welfare, which is sometimes called in the 16th century the commonwealth. That means that we give special protection to the claims of households to their private savings up to a certain amount is guaranteed. We give protection to the count of small businesses because our concern is to keep the households intact and functioning as if there had been no crisis, not to continue to live without losing a step. We must keep the local businesses functioning on which the population depends, as without losing a step. So we have a lot of work to do. If you want to build industries, you must build the environment. You must create the transportation systems in which whole complexes of industry can function together. You don't want the vendor, the machine tool plant that services an industrial plant 500 or 1,000 miles away from the plant which the machine tool plant has to service. You want a high density of supporting small industries wherever you intend to put large industries. The great problem of Asia is a lack of sufficient machine tool and machine tool design and related capabilities in the area where people want to put plants. People come along and say, build this plant, build that plant, let's build this big plant, let's build that. It doesn't work because you do not have the local support of supporting industry that you used to have in Germany. All the good German industries had support from machine tool industries, which employ generally 50 to 100, 250 people, under the direction of people with scientific and engineering backgrounds, who would be used by all of the major corporations as indispensable for the development programs of these larger industries. So you must have a corridor of population, power generation, and so forth, which you can develop. For example, in the case of the United States under Lincoln, United States policy from colonial times, from the Americas, was to develop development corridors, both as highways then and as waterways, which would allow the population to move to the inland territories of the United States, the Ohio River Valley, the Mississippi River Valley, and then beyond across the Transcontinental Route. Transcontinental railways are not just railways. The Transcontinental Railways were conceived as development corridors. The way they worked is you would build farms and communities in areas along the route of the railway system. These farms and communities were the source of the wealth which supported the functioning of the railroad and transformed what had otherwise been useless desert land into areas of population and economic development. So the amount of work to be done to ensure the survival of our civilization and our children and grandchildren over the coming 40 to 50 years, to live beyond the crisis which is now tearing down the world, is a great opportunity. And by that, and by science driver programs, which introduce new physical principles and new technologies into that process, we create a future for humanity. We turn the collapse of a rotten system into a bonanza, a great benefit. We use the occasion to get rid of a system which is crushing us, to build up a system under which humanity as a whole can survive. And we would hope that by doing this in this way, that we bring humanity into a sense of what humanity is.